This is Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM in San Francisco. This is Arab Talk with Jess and Jamal. I'm Jess Hannam.
And I'm Jamal Dajani.
Jamal, first, before we begin our show today, we want to wish our viewers and listeners who are celebrating Ramadan, Ramadan Mubarak, Ramadan Kareem. The world's Muslims throughout the world are going to be celebrating Ramadan in the next day or two, Jamal. But Ramadan in Gaza will not be celebratory in the traditional way because news reports are coming out of Gaza right now, Jamal, which paint a very bleak, catastrophic picture of famine. And we're finding out now that children are literally starving to death right before our eyes, right before the world. And in the face of this famine and the starvation, we understand that the Israeli military continues to block supplies coming into Gaza. The United States and the European Union continue to be helpless in the face of forcing Israel to do this. And now what we have is a catastrophe on top of a catastrophe. We'll be getting into this today with the United States building a port in Gaza while Palestinians are literally starving to death. And to add insult to injury, one of the U.S. airdrops into Gaza landed on a house in Gaza and killed five Palestinians, including children, of food that was being airdropped into Gaza. So, Jamal, the situation is bleak. We're going to be talking about a lot of things today, including Biden's, there's no other way to put it, really disturbing State of the Union address in terms of what his plans are for the world as well as for Palestinians in Gaza. We're going to talk about a leaked Israeli lobby presentation by famed pollster Frank Luntz, who basically urged U.S. officials to justify the genocide in Gaza with Hamas based on rape claims, and these rape claims which have been disproven multiple times over. So we'll be talking about that. But before we get to that, Jamal, we're going to hear an interview, very sad interview that you did with Dr. Rula Farra. She's a medical doctor from Houston. She's originally from Gaza. I actually know her family in Gaza, who's lost over 150 members of her extended family as a result of the genocide. She shared stories and explained why a permanent, not a temporary ceasefire is necessary. And she talked about the long-term health effects on Palestinians in Gaza. It's a very sad and profound and disturbing interview, but I'm glad we're going to be watching it.
That's right, Jess. And of course, we have so many Palestinian Americans living in the United States, originally from Gaza. You could have almost any one of them who would tell you a story about losing family members. Every single one of them has lost family members, and their stories are horrifying. Let's watch and listen to Dr. Rula Al-Farra. In a recent joint media presentation given at the United Nations headquarters in New York, members of the Palestinian community who have been directly impacted by Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza provided testimonies about the devastation and its effects on Palestinian women, children, and institutions. Dr. Rula Al-Farra was one of the presenters. She's a medical doctor from Houston, Texas, whose family originates from Gaza and who has had more than 150 members of her extended family murdered during Israel's ongoing onslaught. Dr. Al-Farra spoke to the victims' humanity with poignant accounts and pictures of the deceased from when they were still alive. Calmly transcending the magnitude of her loss, Dr. Al-Farra stated the speaker's mission. She said, "Today, none of us are here for condolences. We're not here for apologies. We're here for immediate action. We have demonstrated that every minute signifies the loss of a life, the starvation of a child, and so we need an immediate and permanent ceasefire, not a temporary ceasefire." Joining us on Arab Talk is Dr. Rula Al-Farra to talk about generational extinction of families in Gaza. Welcome to Arab Talk, Rula.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's begin by, on Thursday, President Biden in his State of the Union address talked about Gaza, and he did not mention a permanent ceasefire, despite millions of people domestically and globally calling for a ceasefire, including protesters right outside the White House and Capitol Hill. Instead, he talked about setting up a pier for bringing aid into Gaza, which will probably take months to construct, releasing the Israeli hostages, and a temporary ceasefire. As you said in your presentation, every minute means the loss of life to Palestinians in Gaza. What do you think about his plan? What do you say to President Biden as an American, as a medical doctor, as a Palestinian?
As a Palestinian-American, a mother, a woman, a physician, and a member of the Al-Fatah family who has been traumatized, who has had so much suffering and devastation, what I can say, and I think per the Secretary General who met with us at the United Nations, his words to us were that the most important thing we can do right now is share the stories of our loss and of our pain. And what I can say and what I can share with you today is how inexpressible and how horrific the devastation and the pain and the suffering that have been inflicted upon my family and our people. And I think once you have an appreciation for how severe and how intensely painful this has been, it should be clear that there's the only solution, acceptable solution right now, should be an immediate and permanent ceasefire so that all of our people are not punished collectively.
You have lost many dear members of your family. You describe some of the agonizing circumstances under which they have been massacred. You recounted the heart-wrenching story about Sabri El-Farra and his pregnant wife. This is not just something that you watch on television. It's near and dear to you. Tell us their story.
So the story of Sabri El-Farra is one of the most heart-wrenching stories that I shared. And I shared it in the context of describing to the UN Security Council members and the Secretary General to describe the relentless and indiscriminate bombing of Gaza that has destroyed the home of virtually all of my family members and forcibly displaced them to Rafah, where they're either living in tents or they're living in homes that are overcrowded and in the most inhumane of conditions. And so Sabri El-Farra, in the month of December, was murdered along with his 9 young children in an airstrike that hit his home, of course, without any warning. His unfortunate wife, who I think of often, survived the loss of her husband and her 9 children. She was 8 months pregnant. She was displaced to a camp in Rafah. And in January, our relatives posted that she gave birth to her baby boy. She named him after his dead father. And the conditions in the camp were so inhumane and harsh that this poor, unfortunate, innocent baby boy was killed 20 days later from the cold, from starvation. And just his mother had to endure this horrific agony that would be any parent's worst nightmare. It's a fate worse than death.
It's terrible. I also want to talk about a 6-year-old Sana who was killed by an Israeli bomb. You showed a picture of her that went viral on social media. In the picture, Sana is wearing her princess dress. You also showed pictures of your own daughters at her age in their princess dresses. And you asked the question, what is the difference? What did you mean by this? And what is your answer to your own question? What does it take to humanize Palestinians in the eyes of the United States and other governments supporting Israel's aggression?
Here's a picture of Sana, and here's the picture of her in her princess dress and my 2 daughters that were born in Houston, Texas, in their princess dresses. And the question was asked so that people can ask themselves, how are their you know, this is something that most people can identify with. You know, all six-year-old girls want to be princesses. Most of us have daughters or nieces or granddaughters that have pictures in their princess dresses. And I think, although it's difficult to fathom or ask oneself, why is it so hard for Americans or for other people around the world to empathize with us? It's important for us to share the stories and meet them at a level where they can identify with us. And I thought that story was particularly poignant because, again, it allows people to think about their own daughters and ask ourselves, you know, my two daughters, they're Palestinian, we're from Gaza, but they were born in Houston, Texas. And we are able to protect them, give them the protection that all children around the world deserves from crimes of humanity. Why should Senna be any different? And this is why I wanted people to be able to identify with her and identify with their own children and see that there is no difference between us and that the same protection, the rights that we owe the children of that live in the United States and in the Western world is also owed to the children of Palestine, and that we have failed them, that all of humanity has failed them in protecting them from such injustices and such horror.
So International Women's Day was recently celebrated across the globe. I think it's salient to talk about the conditions of Palestinian women and girls in Gaza. More than 30,000 people have been murdered by Israel in Gaza. More than 70% of them have been women and children. Those surviving, many of them women and girls, are homeless. The women are widowed, providing for entire families alone. Pregnant women have nowhere to go. What are you hearing about their experiences, such as sanitary conditions, giving birth, caring for newborn infants?
The plight of women and children is nothing short of a humanitarian catastrophe. And actually, as a women's health expert, I will be presenting to the United Nations next week, specifically on the impact of this horrific assault on women and children. We have many, many stories. Just to talk about women, first of all, my first cousin, Dr. Munan Fabra, she's a dentist. She lost her husband. He was killed by an Israeli airstrike in his car while driving to see his parents to check on them because he hadn't heard from them. She's a widow. She has three very young children. She has sent letters that her children have written to her father, to their father, about the pain of their loss, how much they miss their father, that they will never forget that they will never forget him. I have a cousin, Iman al-Fadra, who posted back in October that a woman down the street had given birth to a baby on the rubble of her destroyed home, asking other family members if anybody had supplies and clothing for him to assist that woman. I shared with you the story of Sabri al-Fadra's wife, Iman, who gave birth in the camps with no electricity, with no pain medication, no access to medical care, no clean water. You know, the status of pregnant women having not received any prenatal care, giving birth without access to any emergency medical care, is unfathomable. The impact of starvation, you know, women have higher nutritional requirements. The impact of starvation on pregnant women will significantly be felt for generations to come. Children have been living in complete horror. We have relatives who've texted the horrors of the Israeli bombardments, saying that even though they have been used to bombing for many, many years as Palestinians, the thrill of the bombing is like nothing they've experienced, that all they do is pray all night. And despite their attempts to reassure their children cry and scream in fear all night long. We have relatives who have witnessed their mothers, you know, being buried in the rubble, their sisters being completely shredded to pieces. We have relatives mothers who have posted that they've lost all of their children, and widows and children who have, we've seen pictures of children who have lost both of their parents and have been orphaned. The scale of psychological devastation is unfathomable. It will plague us, the people of Palestine, the women and children, for centuries to come, for generations to come. The living conditions are horrific. They are going for more than 24 hours without any food. They haven't seen the most basic staples like flour, rice, sugar, salt, fruits, vegetables for months. Parents are unable to console their children who are crying from starvation and from thirst. There has been no access to recycling water. We've had a family who is infected with hepatitis A, the women and children as well. They have no access to medical care. My 12-year-old cousin, Abdurrahim al-Farra, was killed in a camp by an Israeli missile, taken by ambulance, but could not get to any functional hospital anywhere nearby that would have saved his life with the level of injuries he had. So family members, women, have been describing that they haven't had any access to sanitation, feminine hygiene products for 5 months now. The devastation and the impact on every single aspect of life for women and children is unimaginable. Children have had all education, schools have been completely destroyed and damaged. So the children have no access to education. I have a cousin who asked for crayons. She asked her aunt to send her crayons because all of her school supplies have been damaged in her bombed home. So all of these, we have to think about the long-term impact on the development of children, on their cognitive, their psychological well-being. And there's so much more to really think about, but those are some of the stories that have been shared to me, with me, by family in Gaza.
One of your relatives with kidney disease died because she had no access to dialysis. Israel has destroyed almost all the hospitals and destroyed the water treatment plants and power plants. As a health professional, what do you see as the long-term impact of these conditions?
This is a public health catastrophe. And both the physical medical impact as well as the psychological and the trauma that has been inflicted upon our people will cause humanitarian catastrophe and plight at a level that is, I think, unprecedented in this century. We will see, you know, the impact of famine on children and women, pregnancies, increased death of children, of babies being born, the lack of access to healthcare for chronic medical conditions. We've already seen many of my family members who have died from chronic medical conditions that was unnecessary and was preventable. The psychological trauma is immeasurable. You know, this is something that is a public health disaster. And, you know, we need to rebuild the entire fabric of our society. The healthcare infrastructure has completely been decimated. It will take years and years of hard work to rebuild that. In the meantime, our people will be subjected to chronic medical conditions, pain, and immense pain and suffering. And it's just difficult to describe in words and without getting emotional about it. I think all of us can appreciate that the people of Gaza and all of Palestine have been forever scarred. And we will never forget the immense horror that we have had to face. And still, most importantly, an end to this needs to come immediately before we can even begin to think about how much work and how difficult it will be to rebuild. But I will say that our people are resilient and that our people are strong and courageous. And despite all of the sadness and the pain that I have witnessed, either by speaking directly to family members or looking at the social media page that our family has on Facebook, we will survive this and we will come out of this even stronger because we are a beautiful people. We value the beauty of our culture and of our history, and that we will be able to overcome this and fight for our basic rights, such as justice and independence and our right to self-determination.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you next, actually. How do you keep in touch with your family members? Pretty much, I assume most of them have been displaced. What have you been hearing from them? And also, talk to us about the Al-Farra family and its connection to Gaza.
Sure. The Al-Farra family is one of the largest families in Khan Yunis. We have over 12,000 family members in Khan Yunis and thousands more around the world. I have received information on multiple fronts. First, I have directly from family members there. You know, there is solar power, and so some of family members there are able to charge their phones, and we can communicate with them on WhatsApp. But we do have a family Facebook page, and our family members then throughout this entire horrific experience have actually been posting information, including announcements on the deaths of family members, pictures of how they died. Every morning, my life since October 7th has been waking up to checking our Facebook page to seeing what horrific crimes have been committed against us. I have family members who have received texts from family in Khan Yunis and in Gaza and in Rafah currently. And so all of that information I have collected and together so we can document this. The catastrophe, because their voices need to be represented and they need to be heard.
You made it very clear when you spoke what your mission and goal was in going to the United Nations. Tell our audience again why an immediate permanent ceasefire is imperative.
I just described to you a level of catastrophe and human suffering that is unimaginable and I think unprecedented in this century. And I think if the stories that I shared, and this is just a microcosm of the suffering. I mean, this is just one family's stories. So you can imagine there are thousands. There were nine other Palestinian Americans with me, including one who had come directly from Gaza, sharing the most horrific of stories. So if that is not enough to convince people around the world that this needs to end immediately, this suffering needs to stop now, then there is no hope for our humanity. And, you know, as a Palestinian American, many of us are in a lot of pain because our voices are not being heard. We're ghosts that are not seen and not heard. And the reason that I agreed, it's difficult. I mean, even doing media is difficult because we are angry. We are angry that our stories have not been shared. And, you know, this is something that, but our Secretary General said to me that the most important thing we can do right now is share these stories because these are real stories. We're not just numbers that are being murdered right now. And so, again, we don't want apologies and we don't want condolences. We just need action. This is not acceptable on any level and should not be by anybody who claims to be a human being in this world. So for that reason, there's nothing else to talk about right now. I can't think of anything else at this moment that is more important than the permanent cessation of the crimes that are being committed against the Palestinian people.
I assume when you talk about not being heard, being invisible, you're really speaking to governments, our government, the Biden administration, the governments in Europe, because we've seen millions of people demonstrating. They're from all sects, from all creeds. They're, you know, demonstrating on a daily basis, calling for a ceasefire. Exactly that. Does this bring you any hope to see, especially the young people and millions of them across the globe marching and calling for ceasefire and standing with Palestinians?
It absolutely does. The solidarity that has been expressed around the world is really what gets us through these very difficult, dark days. This is also unprecedented in the Palestinian narrative. The fact that all of these stories, these pictures and videos have been exposed for the entire world to see, I think is critical. And I think that this is a new beginning for the Palestinian people, and that younger generations do see the truth now, because I think this is a truth that once is seen cannot be unseen and cannot be forgotten. And the change of public opinion is going to be what's most critical, because ultimately that's what will convince our governments at some point. I just, unfortunately, do not think that it is urgent enough at this time to help the people of Gaza. And that's what breaks my heart. We all feel despair, all of us who are protesting, all of us who are sharing our stories, because we feel like we can't do enough to stop this immediately. And so I, you know, ask that all of the people who are in solidarity with us share the stories, make as much noise as you can, and hope that that this will impact the leadership of the Western world and the Arab countries as well. That whatever we have done is appreciated, but it isn't enough. I mean, that is the truth. It hasn't been enough. It's been 5 months. That is unacceptable. So whatever we need to do to bring an end to this immediately needs to be done for the people of Gaza and for all of humanity.
You're talking about people, Palestinians in Gaza are resilient, which they are, but there are fear that there is a plan of ethnic cleansing. Basically, I mean, it is ethnic cleansing, and this has been ongoing since 1948 for Palestinians in general, but that there is a plan to push them out. You know, earlier we were hearing to push them out into Egypt, and now there is actually a new analysis and reports that the plan to construct this humanitarian so-called pier might be also advance into getting people to leave. Because people draw parallels between this and what happened in the 80s in Beirut, when the United States basically facilitated the eviction of the PLO from Lebanon into Cyprus, and that pier also is connected to the Cyprus story. Do you feel people in Gaza are resilient enough to withstand this and stay on their land, even though the country has been destroyed, or they can fall into a trap of being basically pushed out of the country and their homes?
The resilience of the Palestinian people is something that has humbled me in ways that I can't even express to you. We have family members, for example, from the north of Gaza, who have texted that they will refuse to leave their homes, knowing what their fate would be, because they would rather die in dignity than to be forced to leave and be herded around like animals. That some of them, you know, there are stories of people who have, my father was 10 years old when he witnessed the Nakba in Khan Yunis. He told me that there were up to 15 families living with them in their home. And the Palestinian people are not willing to suffer from another Nakba. My cousin told her sister, who lives in California, just a few days ago, her sister asked her, do you need assistance to leave Gaza, to go to Egypt? And she said, as long as there is Za'atar and Zaytun, the Palestine, that they will persist. And I think this statement is moving in so many ways, because it demonstrates the history and the unbreakable bond that we have with the land of Palestine and the beauty of our culture and our history. And it also demonstrates our resilience and our inability to be destroyed and forgotten. So I will end with that story, because I think it's a beautiful story that demonstrates how our people are willing to die for their homeland and to preserve their dignity.
Dr. Rula Al-Farra, thank you for coming on Arab Talk.
Thank you for allowing me to share these stories, and I ask that all of you be able to share the stories of my family and many others who have suffered. Thank you.
That's the voice and the face of Dr. Rula Al-Farra, a Palestinian physician who's lost over 150 family members in Gaza, living in Houston right now. Incredibly sad and disturbing portrayal of life in Gaza right now, Jamal, something that I know we've been talking about. But for Dr. Al-Farra, who's lost over 150 family members, the grief and the pain that she has had to bear living in the United States and hearing about the devastation to her family is truly heart-wrenching and so disturbing. I mean, we're going to be looking at health consequences for Palestinians in Gaza, Jamal, for generations now. Even if there's a ceasefire right now, we're going to be looking at health consequences for children that's going to go on for decades and decades. And this is why, and she says this, why a permanent ceasefire is absolutely necessary, not the temporary kind of doublespeak that we're hearing from the Biden administration.
Which brings me to the our next story, Jess, which is the State of the Union that was delivered this past Thursday by President Biden, where I don't want to get into the whole State of the Union speech because there are also a lot of things that he said that we can discuss, but I want to focus on what he said about Gaza, which is really very disturbing. You know, when President Biden left the White House to head to Capitol Hill, he was met with demonstrators asking for a ceasefire.
That's right.
Blocking his way. When he left Capitol Hill, he was also met by demonstrators blocking his way. They had to actually reroute his, limousine and asking for a permanent ceasefire. He cannot bring it on himself to say the word permanent ceasefire.
He can't.
Despite all the killing. For the first time, by the way, if you remember, he said maybe Palestinians are exaggerating their deaths. At the State of the Union, he quotes what they tried to dispute, the figures that are provided by the so-called Hamas Health Ministry, that 30,000 Palestinians have died. So now he accepts the fact that there are 30,000 Palestinians who have been killed. Most of them are civilians. He said that. Most of them are civilians. And he does not want to see Israel kill another 30,000. Okay, so what are you waiting for? What
exactly
are you waiting for? If you don't want to see another 30,000 Palestinians getting killed, women and children, in Gaza, he was not able to say, well, we got to have a permanent ceasefire. Imagine. Let's talk about this is the temporary ceasefire, because he starts with bringing the hostages back. And by the way, he again parrots Israeli Hasbara or Israeli lies that about the rape, which we discussed it several times on the show, that this has been debunked, these stories. I mean, this is how he begins talking about what's happening in Gaza. And then he talks about the U.S. military now is going to be building a port or a pier on Gaza's Mediterranean coast to receive humanitarian aid by sea, which is going to take at least 2 months.
It's such a joke to construct. Yeah, it's a joke, Jamal.
And we know what happens in these 2 months. Palestinians are getting killed. More than 100 Palestinians is getting killed every single day. And then the spear, they're having planning for it to operate out of the island of Cyprus. And he does not envision deployment of U.S. military personnel in Gaza, which I find it strange because how are you going to hook up the pier to land?
Well,
I mean,
Jamal,
you gotta deploy the military
right
there, and that's his solution. His solution is basically let's build the pier. Of course, his earlier solution, which was mimicking what the Jordanians and the French did, dropping. A little amount of meals to the population when he has all the power
to force Israel to open, the borders,
but
to allow the 2,000 trucks that are waiting.
But isn't that the real story, Jamal? What a complete gaslighting and bizarre State of the Union address, and Biden trying to show some empathy for the 30,000 Palestinians that have been murdered, the 15,000 children that have been murdered, the children that are starving to death. Can't we just look at the reality right now? He is sending bombs to Israel still, Jamal. He's still sending military supplies to Israel. He's still arming Israel in this genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. And most importantly, and this was said within the last 24 hours, he has said there are no red lines for Israel when it comes to the genocide. So why should anybody believe Genocide Joe when he says he's going to build a pier and that Palestinians are going to, you know, stem the tide of this humanitarian crisis? No one believes him. It's a complete moral failure on the part of Genocide Joe, on President Biden, to do what he does. In 2 months, Jamal, do you know how many children are going to starve to death in 2 months while this pier is being built? And we know, and the UN has said this, humanitarian experts have said this, the quickest, most immediate way to stop famine and starvation to death is trucks on the ground. But he refuses to force and demand that Israel let trucks into Gaza to forestall the famine and the starvation. And with that, and sending bombs, Jamal, so my question to you is, does anybody with any sense of moral clarity believe Joe Biden anymore when it comes to Gaza? No one, nobody, even the European Union is beginning to question the Biden policy because he continues to give a green light to the Israeli government to commit genocide in Gaza. It's a bit of a moral failure, Jamal. Nobody believes Joe Biden. Do you?
No, no one believes Joe Biden. And now we're finding out that he kept sending shipments to Israel, military shipments, bombs, bypassing Congress. I mean, most people...
He continues to do that. Yeah,
most
he
people
continues.
Heard about the initial shipments and authorization to send them more arms and et cetera. But actually, I think more than 100 shipments were sent to Israel to replenish their supplies, more bombs, more 2,000-ton bombs to give them to drop on the people in Gaza. And then he wants to airdrop a few meals that last only one day to a very small percentage of the population. The other thing that just is very worrisome, and people don't talk about this whole idea of Cyprus and creating this, I guess, pier bridge, whatever you want to call it, is very worrisome because if you recall in the 80s, this was the way to evict the Palestinians out of Lebanon through Cyprus, so creating the same idea and then spreading them over, sending them over to Tunisia and Algeria and other countries, that this pier would become permanent, encouraging a lot of the Palestinians in Gaza to leave because they're so desperate. They lost their homes. It's going to take years to rebuild their homes. And a lot of them, I mean, I see that. A lot of them, they don't want to leave, of course. They want to die there. But I don't blame some of them who want to leave because, you know, their lives have been destroyed. So there is something else behind that, aside from humanitarian aid. And this is something that actually Israel planned for Gaza before October 7th, when the pressure was on it to allow more aid and to open the airport that it has destroyed or to create a port for Gaza. They were talking about having a port in Cyprus where the Israeli military will inspect every shipment going into Gaza. They'll actually redirect it to Ashdod, inspect it, and then send it into Gaza, kind of like at a transition point. Cyprus will be used as a transition point. And lastly, what I want to talk about also in this whole corridor when you have it under the control of the United States and Israel, which that's what you're going to end up with. This is also the sea corridor where you have the gas beneath the Mediterranean that the United States eyes and Israel, of course, eyes, and the large oil companies, the Chevrons and the Exxons, are keeping an eye on. So I just don't look at it as a simple humanitarian act. Let's help, you know, if you really want to help them, first, ceasefire. Second, let the trucks in. They have all the shipments there. You know, you have 2,200 trucks are stuck at the border. Instead of coming with this crazy idea that's going to take 2 months, it's going to cost more money.
But Jamal, we understand this is a political ploy by President Biden and Vice President Harris and Antony Blinken to drop some crumbs, some political crumbs on Palestinians, on the world community, but especially on the uncommitted voters, you know, who are sending a message to Biden that they are going to either not vote or will vote for somebody else, who are protesting every single event that he gets to, that the protests are so intense, Jamal, that the Biden administration is refusing to tell people where he will be ahead of time so that they can't plan these protests. The same thing with Vice President Harris and with Antony Blinken, that the Biden administration realizes as we get closer to November 2024, they are in a world of hurt and a world of problems with the uncommitted votes that are sweeping the country right now. And as we've talked about before, it appears that Biden is headed for a defeat if he doesn't change his geopolitical stance when it comes to Palestine. Now, we know he's not going to do that. So this was an attempt by the Biden administration to drop some crumbs. The problem, Jamal, is that people see through this gaslighting. They see through these political lies. They see the reality, which, as we've said, he continues to send bombs, bypassing Congress. He continues to arm Israel. He continues to say that there are no red lines. And the idea, while Palestinian children are starving to death, that he would create this pier that takes 2 months. Do you know how many children are going to starve to death, Jamal, in 2 months while they're waiting to build
the United Nations pretty much has declared Gaza that there is a famine in Gaza.
Yes,
I mean, and several other organizations, they've now talking about a famine, and he reads this and he hears this from his aides, and that's why he's coming with, he basically, this is what I think about where the Biden administration is miscalculating. They believe they have months, like they can lull the people and 2 months to build the pier, and then he'll come out as a hero, rescuing the people in Gaza, bringing them sacks of flour and rice and water and so forth. And then he will be forgiven right here in this country, and those uncommitted voters will go back to him.
It's not going to work, Jamal. People don't buy it. I'll tell you something about the uncommitted. The uncommitted voters are people who are very clear, who are very unambiguous, who understand the dynamics of the Biden lies and what Biden is doing to support the genocide in Israel. They're not going to accept these crumbs, just like the Arab world, you know, people on the street, not necessarily the leadership, obviously, is going to accept this. And so Biden continues to undermine the possibility of him having a second term. I will say this, as I've said before, that when Donald Trump is elected president in 2024, the Democrats will only have to blame themselves for this. They have no one else to blame. They will try to blame uncommitted. They'll try to blame Arab Americans. They'll try to, I mean, whoever they try to blame. But it's clear that the only people to blame when Donald Trump is reelected in 2024 will be Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and the Democrats themselves. They are the only ones to blame for this moral failure. And I'll tell you, Jamal, the uncommitted votes, the peace activists, the pro-Palestine solidarity activists are only growing because they listened to the State of the Union address and they saw right through it. They didn't buy the BS of trying to somehow build this pier. People understand that it takes 2 months. And even the amount of food that can be brought in on ships doesn't even compare to the amount of food, water, and medicine that can be brought in by trucks. And we also know, we need to say this, Jamal, Israel continues to block the trucks from Kerem Shalom as well as Rafah with Egypt every single day. Every single day. They're blocking food, water, and medicine. And this is the reality on the ground that people see.
Moving on to our next story, Jess, which is an important story because we've been talking about this debunked rape story that Israel now, by the way, just want to remind our listeners and viewers, no one hears about the 40 babies and the 40 beheaded babies.
They don't hear about it anymore.
Which was the headlines, which was also parroted by President Biden, that he saw pictures, which he never saw any pictures. So not a single media outlet is talking about that. So they moved on now to this debunked rape story, and which was debunked by several organizations. And no evidence has been provided, including when the United Nations presented their findings. They said, we are citing Israeli sources, and we have not been presented with any evidence or any material to support it. So now here is the newest, which is leaked Israel lobby presentation, which urges U.S. officials to justify the war on Gaza with the Hamas claims. And again, kudos to the Gray Zone, which obtained slides from a confidential Israel lobby presentation based on data from Republican pollster Frank Luntz. You know, they contain talking points for politicians and public figures, and of course the media, seeking to justify Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip. So here they are. Here we go again. You know,
this here we
is,
go.
This is, you know, from two prominent pro-Israel lobby groups, which held a private briefing in New York, basically coaching elected officials and well-known figures on how to influence public opinion in favor of Israel's military rampage in Gaza, and really to justify the genocide.
Well, that's exactly what it is, Jamal. I mean, basically what this is, and by the way, just so that our listeners and viewers know, Frank Luntz is a notorious pro-Israel pollster. Notorious. And that he's been responsible for much, if not most, of the talking points that AIPAC has constructed over the decade. Last decade, at least, Jamal, if not longer. And our listeners and viewers just need to understand and maybe take a step back to really understand the depravity, the moral depravity of what they're saying. Even though this information has been debunked, even though this information has been shown to be false, even though this information has been retracted, we have Frank Luntz and AIPAC. And by the way, both for Republicans and Democrats to push the debunked Hamas story to justify the genocide. People, when they hear this, should really be able to kind of confront the fact that this is the kind of thing that is operating within AIPAC in order to promote both Democrat and Republican candidates who are going to be pro-Israel. This is what they're telling them to say, Jamal. And so we need to take a step back, right? What are the implications of this? How are politicians able to wrap their heads around, you know, speaking these kinds of propaganda lies in order to get elected or reelected? I think this is a big story, but I'm afraid that I'm not hearing this from many other places.
It is a big story. Well, you're not going to hear about it because other places are partook in this. I mean, Luntz is invited on CNN and on Fox News. I've seen him many times there, you know,
yeah,
talking there. So he's their coach. And he comes up with this, you know, usually for, you know, during the elections, advising right. candidates and advising parties and whatever. But this, these are, he came up with these talking points basically to American politicians. They're not for the Israelis. I mean, the Israelis also, these are their talking points. They keep changing their lives on a daily basis. But these are for American politicians. When you see these Congress men and women questioned and challenged about supporting a genocide, they'll come up and say, well, what about the rape story? What about this? What about that? So they give them this whataboutism to challenge you back with. And then I can read a lot of the stuff that, you know, they put a whole list of things how to answer to and how to justify, you know, like the lens-tested presentations on the war of Gaza. For example, urges politicians to avoid trumpeting America's supposedly shared democratic values with Israel, because nobody now believes the shared democratic values, neither in the United States or on the Israel side, and focus instead on deploying the language of war with Hamas. This is what they called it. According to this framing, they must deploy incendiary language, painting Hamas as a brutal and savage organization of hate, which has raped women, while insisting Israel engaged in a war for humanity. I mean, those are, and how to compare what happened in October 7 with 9/11 to say this is Israel's 9/11, to describe Palestinians as brutal, savages, and inhumane, that they are Iranian-backed, Iranian-funded, you know, they violated international humanitarian law. I mean, it's a whole list. We can spend an hour talking about it. But the crazy thing about it, this is attended by movers and shakers. I'm talking about...
And Democrats and Republicans.
Democrats and Republicans and media personalities.
Exactly. This is why, Jamal, this is why, you're right, this is why, this being exposed is going to further create this malaise for the American voter, and especially progressive American voters coming up. People are going to read this. They're going to be disgusted by it. And it's going to lead to people not wanting to vote in 2024 or vote for third-party candidates. People see this, and it makes them sick to see this kind of propaganda being waged right now in the face of the genocide and in the face of the famine. So, I mean, this, you're right. We're not going to see this kind of reporting on CNN or other mainstream media outlets. Even the New York Times, Jamal, it's important to say this, even the New York Times is refusing to fully retract the misrepresentation in their reporting about these stories. So, you know, I think it seems like the Democrats and the Republicans are digging themselves into a very deep, deep hole right now. I don't see how they get out of it. This is not going to be good.
And they're getting their marching orders from AIPAC. They're getting their marching orders from someone like Luntz, who brags about taking his photo. He posts his photo on his whatever Twitter feed with the Israeli military. And then he conducts this poll to see the effect. And I just want to quickly say, like, about the Hamas rape and ask people, what bothers you the most? I mean, these are just regular people. Raping civilians, that's number one. Massacre civilians, they get 31% for raping civilians. Massacre civilians, 28%. He puts all these things, bound and burned civilians, 26%. This rings a bell, right? So when you say about children burned in an oven, you know, and women are getting raped and massacred and then butchered. You know, he goes down the list, and then he finds out that the top story that rings a bell and moves emotions in the United States is raping women. So now he feeds this to all these politicians and to all these media personalities, and they keep repeating this time and time again, when, as you've mentioned, this has been debunked, including that made-up story in the New York Times by an Israeli former intelligence officer, you know, who wrote the story or participated in writing the story. And now they find themselves, like again, last week I've mentioned, it took the New York Times one whole year to apologize for the lies of Judith Miller in Iraq.
Right.
So I think that's what they're doing, because they know now this is not the time. They'll wait 1 year after Israel is totally destroyed, just like what happened in Iraq. A million Iraqis were killed, to say, oops, we made a mistake. Our sources were incorrect.
Well, you know, this is why people don't trust the New York Times. This is why people don't trust government anymore. This is why people feel hopeless and helpless about the election coming up in 2024. Because I really think, Jamal, most Americans feel in their hearts, understand the moral depravity of genocide, and understand that it's morally wrong to starve a civilian population to death, to starve children to death. They understand that in their hearts. They understand it deeply. And when they read, you know, these, you know, basically propaganda points in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, CNN, whatever, and they hear the kind of bizarre rhetoric coming from Biden and from Harris and from Blinken, they just say, you know, we are not going to participate in this farce. And, you know, these protests are not going away, Jamal. I mean, this is something that is really freaking out the Biden campaign and the administration. These protests are not stopping. In fact, they're growing. Big trouble ahead.
You've been listening to Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. Go to our website, arabtalkradio.com, to download the latest shows, and we'll talk to you next week.
See you next week.